The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome. It is so wonderful to be here in Philadelphia and be with you all. My name is David Norse Thomas. I am the husband of the incredible author that we are all here to see. And I get to introduce him today. So I first saw Eric at the William Way LGBT Center here in town at a panel that was about LGBT people who are religious leaders. And Eric was hosting the panel, and he was full of hope and possibility, along with hurt and honesty. And as the discussion was coming to a close, I asked a question about how queer people who have privilege have responsibility. What is our responsibility as people of faith for being intersectional in our work for justice in the world? And he squinted at the lights. He couldn't see who I was. And he said, "You should be up on this panel on this stage with me." It took a little while, but it happened. We didn't get to meet in person, though, for a bit. Eric started hosting The Moth here in Philadelphia, which... It's like, know your audience, right? When Eric started hosting, a congregant at Broad Street Ministry asked me if I wanted to go. He said, "There's this great host. I think you'd really like him." And I was delightfully surprised to see Eric up there and start putting things together. It was especially unique in that moment because I had an email inviting me to the next round of that queer religious leaders panel. And I wasn't sure if I was going to do it. And so I turned to my friend Colton and I said, "Should I do it? Should I go on this panel with Eric?" And he said, "Yes." He was very excited. And I asked him why he was just a little bit too enthusiastic. And he said, "It's all part of my plan. You're going to meet him, you're going to fall in love, and you're going to get married." So he's my favorite congregant of all time. And today I get to introduce you to my best friend, my husband, and my favorite person to explore the world with, the incomparable R. Eric Thomas. Raised in Baltimore by amazing parents, he comes from a people brimming with love and encouragement, curiosity and faith in what isn't seen, but could and should be. It's a faith and hope made all the more audacious given the challenges, tragedies, and nonsense that they've stared down, overcome through tenacity and a lot of laughter. Eric grew up in a family so bursting with life and humor that it took him moving away from Baltimore to realize that he was actually funny. Many of us came to know Eric through his plays, from the Barrymore Award-winning Time Is On Our Side to his upcoming... to his upcoming production of An Army of Lovers, the moving premiere at Baltimore Center Stage of The Folks at Home, to the hilarious Crying on Television. Still, others of us encountered Eric's sharp wit and riotous whimsy through his digital column on Elle, Eric Reads the News, which was beloved and shared through social media. We can applaud for that. That was... It got us through a lot. It was something that was beloved and shared on social media, and it navigated the intersection of pop culture and politics in a way that made all of us have to look things up, from references to classic literature to what Madonna was wearing in 1992. Eric has written for TV, and he is a proud member on strike of the Screenwriters Guild. His previous books include the best-selling Here For It or How to Save Your Soul in America. He co-authored with Helena Andrews Dyer, Reclaiming Her Time, The Power of Maxine Waters. and his young adult novel, The Kings of Beemore, was named a 2023 Stonewall Honor Book by the American Library Association. With all of these accomplishments and moments of incredible high and joy, the other thing that you should know about Eric is when things are bad, he is the best person to have in your corner. The last 5 years have been incredibly difficult in our lives for a multitude of reasons, from having to leave our beloved city of Philadelphia for a little something that happened in November of 2016 that I can't really remember, thank God, to losing jobs, the death of my father, so many moments of just incredible tumult and sadness. And yet, in all of that, that same tenacity, that hope, that faith, that love and joy, that encouragement beyond all else shines through. And so I hope with this book that you have or that you will have soon, that you will share with friends, that you can have Eric with you too in those dark times so that they can be full of the same laughter and wit and joy that is something that has gotten us to this point and I hope will get us many years into the future. So friends, please join me in applauding and stand, go crazy as we welcome my husband, the amazing R. Eric Thomas.
Oh my gosh, hello, hello, hello. Oh my goodness, hi, hi, hi. Oh my God, sit down. Oh my goodness gracious. What an introduction. My goodness, you all should have David introduce you to things. I was back there. I was like, who's this guy? What's going on? What's happening up there? That was incredible. I'm really quite touched. I'm like, I got to follow that, which I suppose I'll try. So the last time I was here was like February 27th, 2020. So how was everyone's 2 weeks following that? It's good to everyone have a good time, good early spring. So I am really excited to be back, and I'm like knocked a lot of wood that, like, you know what, we're just going to keep going. We're just going to keep going after this book event, and it's not going to be the harbinger of doom that my last book event was, which is, you know, like, it's not my fault, you know, a little bit. But I have to say, so we were supposed to start this book tour in Washington, D.C. last night, and I was going to be in conversation with Chasten Buttigieg. And that's not me dropping a name. That's literally saying the name of a famous person I'm friends with. And so I was, you know, I was going to be talking with my friend whose husband is the 14th in line to the presidency. I'm just giving you context. I'm just giving you information. I don't need to tell you these things, but you're like, I don't know who that person is. And I'm like, well, I'm trying to help you out. So I'm in the hotel. I've got stuff going on, and I get a text from Justin, my friend, whose husband is Pete Buttigieg. And it's just like a screenshot of like the weather, like an app, and I was like, I don't know how to read this, babe. I'm not Adam Joseph. And so he's like, local references. I don't know what I'm going to say tomorrow in Nashville. I'll be like, what do you guys have down here, a weather guy? And so, you know, there's like, it's like a tornado watch at a 4 out of 5. Like, you know, so it's like really bad. Like 5 is like, you know, and like 4 is like, get inside. And so they were talking about closing government offices and this and that. And he's like, well, what does your team say? And I was like, I don't know. I haven't talked to my team there. I don't know. So then right at the same time as I'm trying to figure it out, my mother gets like texts me a picture of like the television and the weather's on there. And she's like, what does your team say? And I was like, folks, can Justin and my mom like just talk to each other? Like, and I'm just like, and I think if, you know, if anyone's going to, you know, hash it out, it's the two of them. And so we eventually had to cancel the event, which I know, but that means that we're opening this tour here in Philly, which feels very right. And this is home, and this is a book about going home. It's a book about leaving Philly that begins with leaving Philly. It's an inciting incident, storytelling. Do the bad things happen because I left Philly? No, but But I just think it's funny, as I was like, as we were driving up here, I was like, I've tried so hard to sort of create good energy around this. I really, you know, this is what I do for a living. And so I wasn't going out. I was like, I can't get COVID for this tour. And the universe was like, you thought of everything. You thought of COVID, but did you think of tornadoes? And it does feel like that's kind of the era that we're in now, unfortunately. And I was like, don't I want to bring this energy into the room so early on? But the book is called Congratulations, the Best is Over. That energy is kind of in this room already, where we're all kind of like, so this now. And it does feel like there are times where you're like, I have thought of all the bad things that I'm aware of. What else? You're like, oh, I've got a summer wedding, and we have a tent in case there's a rain. Have you thought of killer bees? And I think, so the question that I sort of began this book thinking about is, what, like, and am I, is this what it is? You know, and it started off in small ways. We moved back to Baltimore for David's job, and that's where I'm from. And I was like, oh, this beautiful period in Philadelphia is over. And then different things started to change, and on a personal level, and then on a national level, and then on a global level. And every point, I think I asked myself, I think we all asked ourselves at different points, is this it? And not like, is this the new normal? Is this the new abnormal, like, I'm not going to talk too much about the pandemic. You're aware of it, I think. If you're not, you should Google, you know. Someone's like, what? What happened? Oh, I was at... I'm going to read from the book in a second, I imagine. You all have it. You know, like, at your leisure. You know, whenever. If you get bored, you're like, okay, well, let's see what this is all about. I was at the musical Hadestown a little while ago. Really great, right? And like, you know, I'm going to spoil but not spoil it. So it's about, you know, Orpheus and Eurydice and, you know, the myth and like, you know, like they're trying to get out of the underworld, and the command is you can't, you know, can't look back, and then like Eurydice looks back, and so she has to go to the underworld. So like the whole musical happens. This is, you know, 6,000 years old. And at the right of the climax, Eurydice looks back, and I heard this person across the auditorium go, oh! And I was like, oh, this person was not prepared for Hades. And I feel like, so like anyone who hasn't heard of the pandemic is like, oh no. Oh, you zoomed from home. But I don't want to talk about it a lot, but I one of the things that really stuck out, one of the things I write in this book, is that there are times where it felt like being in like a working apocalypse, like having a salad at your desk. You're like, okay, I do think everything is falling apart, but unfortunately I have a 3 o'clock and a 4 o'clock, which is hilarious in retrospect. And that's the tension that I have been trying to tackle in my life, and I'm trying to tackle in this book, this tension of like, I cannot believe this is happening, and also, I cannot believe this is happening. And it all starts with relocating, and so I'm going to read a little portion from that very beginning. David's new church was going to pay for relocation. David found a moving company that fit the price point and specialized in moving clergy. Most clergy come with large libraries, I was informed, and so these companies were adept at moving all the household items, as well as, like, the Shroud of Turin, and a bunch of books. We did indeed have a bunch of books in our combined libraries. David's were clergy stuff, God Matters, the Book of Life. Mine were many copies of The Pelican Brief by John Grisham. It's an incredible book. The moving company had a website full of glowing reviews and promised 3 expert movers who would also professionally pack your stuff. I'd never used movers or packers before, so it was especially thrilling to step into the phase of life where I didn't have to test the bonds of friendship by offering a pizza in exchange for struggling up a staircase with one of 900 poorly taped boxes. This is the life you lived. Before this, I'd written about how the new apartment had a Nancy Myers kitchen. This is the life you lived when you had a Nancy Myers kitchen island near the stream. This was the new Baltimore story for me. This is the new Baltimore story for me. I saw it again with a different inflection around 6 p.m. on moving day as I lay on my back in the furnitureless apartment and stared up at the sky through the wall of windows. We'd started moving day in Philly at 8 in the morning. David and I had arrived in Baltimore at 5 p.m., the movers following behind us. But as David was discovering from a phone call, their truck had broken down on the highway, and they had no idea when they or any of our belongings would arrive. Things were not ideal. Hours went by. 6 p.m. turned to 9 p.m. No movement on the truck. My mother came by with Boston Market for dinner. She picked up paper plates at the grocery store, since all of our plates and clothes and copies of the Pelican Brief were sitting somewhere on I-95. She offered to let us crash on one of the 4 pull-out sofas in my parents' house. She's so mad that we never sleep there. She's like, we bought all these pull-out sofas, and you all want to live in your houses, which is incredible to me, because we're like, we were moving to Baltimore. She was, and like, still, years would go by, and she's like, do you want to come over and sleep on the pullout couch? No, I have a bed. But thank you. So anyway, she invited us to sleep over there, but we protested we wanted to be there when our stuff arrived, whenever that was. She went home and told us to call her when the movers got there. I sat on the floor eating Boston Market macaroni and cheese from a paper plate that read "Happy Birthday." It was no one's birthday, which I found even more enjoyable. All in all, it was a kind of lovely evening. Gorgeous place, lots of space. I'd accidentally Marie Kondo'd my entire life. And you know what? She's got a point. Plus, I got to eat an objectively good mac and cheese. I don't think it risks my black card to say this, okay? Boston Market mac and cheese is good. It's very good. It's a wonderfully flavorful European-American mac. So congratulations to the city of Boston. Congratulations to Chef Ben Affleck. Anyway, I'll stop it there. So things... things go... that's how we began our journey, and things go downhill from there. And there was this point... They got to the new apartment at, I want to, like, probably 3 or 4 a.m. It's in the book. I don't remember. I haven't read it. And it's, like, these 2 trucks, and there's a tow truck, like, with the other truck on the back of it, like a transformer or something, like, and then another truck. But it didn't fit in the garage of this luxury apartment building. And so they had to unload all of our belongings on the side of this windy road, like we were being reverse broken up with. And then David and I had to carry our belongings into this house that we didn't want to be in. And I was in the middle of that. Like, it was truly like we were during Watergate. And I was like, oh, this is my life. But also, this is the story. And I kept having these moments where I was like, this is my life? Oh, this is the story. And that's a fun thing when you're like, I guess I'm going to be a writer more. But it's also very disorienting, because if you're in the middle of the story, you don't know how it's going to turn out. You don't know whether you get what you want. You don't know whether you survive to see the end. And I think that is... the disorientation became the sort of drumbeat of this time in Baltimore, this sort of like, where am I in my story? Am I in my story at all? Do I have the right goals? Do I have the right wants? Am I going to get to the other side? And what's waiting over there? Will I be happy with it? And that disorientation, like, led to, and it's so funny, I don't want to talk about this, but it's like in the book. And my editor's like, Eric, if it's in the book, they're going to know about it. And I'm like, okay, but it's really a real downer. But like, I had a lot of trouble with I've always had like a sort of relationship with depression. I don't want to say a struggle with depression, because it's like, I don't have a lot of enemies. And so it's like, I'm not going to like struggle, you know, like, I'm just like, we're in a relationship. And like, my editor, she was like, just, I'm going to do this. So my editor, she was just like, just say it plain. Just say like, you were sad, and say why. And I'm like, okay, but what if I like roasted my depression? Like, I was like a Comedy Central roast of like Pamela Anderson. And she's like, just say it. And I was like, no, that feels like a downer in this book. And she was like, just write what it is, right? I was depressed, and this is how, and this is what it felt like. And I was like, Sarah, I got to be honest with you. I know you've edited many books by many great people. That's the most boring thing I've ever heard. And I don't think everyone's depression is boring. I think mine is. And so that, like, and so even as I was going through these periods where I was just like, I think that I'm in a weird dark period of my life, and I moved back to a place where all the ghosts of my old self used to be, and I miss the people and the places that I know so well. I'm like, you know, okay, not interesting. But it doesn't have to be interesting. And I read a book called Broken in the Best Possible Way by Jenny Lawson. Incredible. Yep. Oh, yes, 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 yes. Yes, yes. Here she, Jenny Lawson. to tepid applause. No, she's incredible. She's incredible. And she wrote this, she's a very funny author, and then she wrote this one essay where she just literally just talks very straightforwardly about her mental health struggles. And I found that to be really interesting and really encouraging. And one of the things that I took from that, and it's a lesson that I continue to sort of think about and learn, is that you don't know who your story is going to help. You don't know who is going to identify with your truth. And sometimes you just have to say it. But that was not a thing that I knew when I was going through all this in Baltimore. Yeah. I'm going to skip to a different part. See, I'm so uncomfortable talking about it. Actually, you know what? No, I'm going to tell you this. So I had this period where I was like, but I'm writing this column online where I'm making jokes every day. And I'm like, ha, 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 Ivanka Trump, ha, ha. But I'm also like, ha, ha, ha. And I really struggled to like make like adult friends, like friends as like in Baltimore, which is like not, you know, my fault. Making friends as an adult is a deeply embarrassing experience. And I moved, you know, I moved back to this city where I knew people from before, but I didn't really know, I didn't have the same connections. And like, you know, when you're making friends with other adults, you have to like, you're like, hello, we met at a party, and that's not an exclamation point, that's a period. You said you liked events and situations, and I also like events and situations, so would you like to do something at some point? And then they write like, yeah, sure. And you're like, oh my gosh, amazing. How glorious, thank you. Please excuse my enthusiasm. I know it's gauche. And then you're like, okay, so when should we do this? And they're like, oh yeah, absolutely, I cannot wait to hang out. I am free in 6 years when my kids graduate. But we should probably put in the calendar right now because I will lose that date. And that's all the time. And you're like, I guess maybe I should try rock climbing. So I tried rock climbing. And that's a pretty solitary activity, so I don't really know what I thought I was doing. I would go to this coffee shop where everyone was so cool and they wore Carhartt jackets all the time. And I would drink a lot of coffee and I would get out of my mind. And then I would go online and I would just like tweet about my favorite Glee episodes all day long. And that's not a great way to make friends in real life. And so I found myself really isolated. And one of the things that I found about, and I'm not an expert on, you know, not feeling super great, but I do think this is true. And my husband's a therapist, so, you know, if you can sue him if I'm telling you something that's not true. But that depression tells you that you are the only one, and it tells you that you're alone, and it's never going to get any better. And none of those things are true, but you need somebody to remind you of that. And so I had a therapist that I was, like, talking to. I'm, like, talking to this therapist. And, like, no, we're, like, having, you know, sessions or whatever. And he was really great. But I still, like, would find myself, like, needing something else. And so I took this, like, mental health day, and I write about this in the book. And it's weird to take a mental health day when you work from home because you're like, well, as per usual, I will be staying in bed. And so I was like, well, I can't just stay in the house. So I went and I went to the mall and I just sat on a bench and I was just sad in public, which is so dramatic. And I was like, what are all these other people doing here? Are we all just having mental health crises at the mall? I was like, nobody has a job. And this was pre-pandemic. So I was like, y'all need to get in the house. Y'all need to energize the economy. And so then I was like, okay, well, I'm near the place where my grandparents are buried. I thought I was wrong. And so I was like, well, I'll just go visit. And so I write about visiting my mother's grandparents in the book, and I'm going to skip over that part. It was really interesting. I think it was interesting, but I do want to talk about. But I ended the day of depression errands at my at the Black Cemetery, King Memorial, where my father's parents are buried. And I walk into this office, and I'm like, I had been quiet and alone and silent all day, and it was full of Black people in starched clothing, business casual and formal, and like starched suits and cuffs, and there was these two secretaries behind, or receptionists, or I'm not, you know, assistants behind the desk, and they were like joking with each other about the office lottery. And I love the office lottery. It's the most wonderful, because it's the thing that you can admit to everybody that you don't want to be here either. You know, you're like, well, you give me a dollar and we can pretend that we're going to leave this place. And I was like, oh man, 25 years ago, I like collapsed right here, despondent. And now there's laughter, and it smelled like coconut lime verbena from Bath and Body Works. which was delightful. And they were joking with me, and I was found myself laughing. And I was like, oh my God, this container that held so much pain also holds joy too. And eventually I go out and I try to find the graves, and this is one little portion from there. My father's father died before I was born, a preacher, a man with a dozen little jobs to make ends meet, a worker, smiling round face and sepia-toned photo of him in his late 50s, my grandmother's arms around his neck. The photo stayed on her wall the entire time she lived in the apartment on the first floor of our house. All of her photos were covered in saran wrap and thumbtacked to the walls. I'd visit daily, and I'd stare at her in the photo, dark brown skin, white hair cut close and unnatural, smile huge. Her voice was like a fire alarm, high-pitched and throaty at the same time, the sound of it charging up through the floors of our house. From her apartment underneath, hymns. Other times, she would let loose a scream in mock frustration that barely masked something truer, deeper. On car rides to appointments, we'd pass one particular stretch of road, and every time it would remind her of her brother and prompt her to remark, Uncle Steve sends his love. Her favorite treats? Cafe Vienna International Coffee in the tin can, which I thought was very fancy, and a little swirled pecan roll. One of my favorite of the photos my grandmother wrapped in saran wrap and thumbtacked to her walls finds her standing in front of a bus on a trip with friends from church. Her hand is on her hip, just below the cinched waist of her trench coat, her head thrown back, glamorous and cheeky. She looks confident and jubilant, unselfconscious and fully present. The destination displayed on the bus reads Atlantic City. All my life, I've thought about that trip to Atlantic City and what delights she must have found there and the memories she bound up in that photograph. I hope it was a wonderful day. One of the reasons that I wrote this book was to call back into the space that we're sharing the things that have been lost. And in this course of this book, as David talked about, we lose family, and I think we've all sort of lost something in the last 5 years. And some of it is stuff that we can believe we can get back, but some of it is a world that kind of doesn't exist anymore. And this book ends with a portion where we move out to a house and we have this beautiful garden that David plants and that I fail at on a very regular basis. And we don't live in that house anymore. But people, when they interview me about this book, this book that ends before we move back here. And so they say, how's the garden? Oh, God, it must be so beautiful. And there's the first time I got asked that question, I got a little catch in my throat because there's a little grief in leaving it. But one of the things I know is that we plant seeds that we will never see the end of. We plant things that will outlive us and that will outlive everything that we know. And we plant a garden not only for us, but for those that come after us and those that we've never met before. And I think about, and then when I didn't know this at the time when I was going my depression errands, I was like going back to this garden space, going back to this place and trying to find a root or a branch to hold on to. And I tell people in interviews, I'm like, it's gorgeous right now. I actually asked David the other day. I was like, do you want to rent a drone and and just go look? And we don't have like any relationship with the people who own it. they didn't pay us, but they should have. And so we can't fly a drone over their house, apparently. But I can see it in my mind. And you know that there is sometimes there's 2-year gardens and 3-year gardens and 4-year gardens. And I didn't know this. I thought you plop, boom, you know, Fern Gully. And so there are years that we've been away from this place, and there are cattails shooting up by the pond, and there's marionberry bushes that are overflowing. This garden is so much bigger than us. And that makes me feel so deeply hopeful. One of the things that I always try and do when I'm writing books is to reach for hope, to reach for something that is bigger than my present circumstance. And I find that in laughter, but I also find that in the idea of continuum, the idea that the question that the book asks, is the best over? I think that something is over, but it may have been the best in the moment, but there's still more best yet to come. And I think of myself as a person in the garden, and as a gardener, and as a plant. And so I'm going to steal this one thing from Mr. Rogers. I'm going to ask you just to think about who planted the garden that you're in right now. Who planted the garden for you? Maybe it's one or two people. Maybe it's a whole bunch of people. Who created the space that you're in? And I want you to think about who you're planting the garden for, who you want this world to exist for, tomorrow, next week, after the next tornado, or the next nothing. And think about the space that you occupy in between those two things. I write in the beginning of this book that this book is about being in the middle. And for much of the portion that I was in the middle, of whether it's the middle of transitioning states or the middle, my therapist at one point was like, well, you're entering middle age, so this is normal. And I was like, Brian. The middle of political upheaval, the middle of a time that we're like, I think we're going to get better, maybe not, the middle of something that we can't see, the middle of something great. And a lot of that was torturous. But I think now about this middle space as this place of growing, of decomposition and reconstitution, of new leaves sprouting up, of things blossoming, of us putting our hands in the dirt and putting more seeds down so that we are not the last people to walk across here, and that the people that we know, the people that you're thinking of, can walk in the same footsteps that we did and find more hope and more joy and more laughter in our wake. I'm gonna stop there. I didn't mean to stop there. I had like a game show I was gonna do. But I'm gonna open up the floor for questions. And if your questions are, what do you think you're doing? That's fine too. So I'll get, if you want to have a question, just raise your hand. Or like throw something at me and I'll Cardi B. Foley, how fascinating. Okay, I will not do that again. If you don't have questions, I also have a game show I can run. Well, give me 1 second. Because I will do it. Don't tap me.
Hi, Eric.
Hi.
What did you miss most about Philly?
What if I was like, nothing?
Fair.
We get it.
I miss walking. You know, it's so funny. Okay, this is going to be recorded. And the people from Baltimore, no shade. But like, people say Baltimore is walkable. But like, I was walking. It's a very hilly city. And you can walk a hill. But I don't want to. And I said to David, I got back, I was doing a signing, signing books in Baltimore, and I was just walking around, and it was so beautiful, it was really lovely. But I was like, I felt this place was always uphill, and that's just not possible. There must have been some downhill, but I didn't encounter it. But Philly, you can walk, you know? I love walking. I love perambulating in the city. Because you run into everyone you've ever met, you know? And that's the best part of being alive, is being like, I didn't intend to see you today, and I'm not so sure I want to, but but we're having a, well, it's so good. How was things? Oh, things? All right. Yeah, okay. Well, we should, So, yeah, I miss that. I miss walking. Yeah, I learned how to drive while I was living in Philly. I was 35 years old. I had not driven a car in my life, and I was like, I'm never going to drive. I would have anxiety when actors would drive in movies, because I'd be like, what if one day I have to do that? What? So, like, by this guy, Nick, taught me how to drive in South Philly, and he was a retired math teacher, and he was always, he was talking about the relationship he had with his ex-wife, pretty good, and his kids, fair to Midland, and, and when I got into the car to do the, so he was going to take me up to the burbs to do my test, because he's like, I know everybody here at these, at the one, they'll let you through, and they did. He was playing, like, a Japanese recorder, and it was, like, so peaceful. And I was like, are you doing this for me? And he was like, no, I'm teaching myself the recorder. And I was like, that makes sense. So he did a good job. I did run my car into multiple garage walls in Baltimore. You can still see it. Come down to South Philly. It's still the same car. But now I'm a very good driver.
I'm curious about what story didn't make the cut in the book.
Oh, my goodness. Well, first of all, that is a great story. Thank you. That is a great question. Thank you. So my editor and I have a really good relationship, but this was a learning experience, I think, for me. And a lot of, like, so much got cut. There's probably about 40,000 words, which is about half a book, that got cut out of this book. And what she doesn't know is 2 years from now, it's going to be, hey, here's another book. Nick got cut out of the book. I tell this one story about, I don't know, I think, the idea was sort of being at home anywhere, or sort of the question of, can you actually ever be sort of not other anywhere? And I talk about how there's a gay bar here called Tavern or Kamak, where the first time I went, somebody was like, you know, this like white guy was like, did you know the basement of this used to be Stop on the Underground Railroad? And I was like, oh, fascinating. All right, you know, great. And I got on to Baltimore, and I go to this dive bar called Leon's, and I'm sitting next to this white guy, and he's like, did you know this used to be a Stop on the Underground Railroad? And I was like, maybe it's true. There's something poetic and rhyming historically about, like, all these spaces of queer liberation also being spaces of black liberation. But maybe that's just something people say to black people in gay bars. I am fine with either, to be honest. And so there was a whole essay that was built on that. There is something that I realized I could not yet write about. Well, there's a lot I feel like I could not yet write about, but there's a lot about trying to find home elsewhere. And I had the opportunity. I was working for, I was doing some consulting for a company that's based in Brazil. And so we were Zooming, but they were like, we're going to bring you down at the end of the project. And I was like, this is a scam, you know? So they bring me down to Salvador, Bahia. And my hosts were like, this place has the highest concentration of African Americans in the world. And I was like, what? And they were like, these people are from Africa, we are in America. And I was like, I'm so sorry. I'm a moron. I'm a United States moron. And I have never been someplace where everyone looked like me. And I'm not Brazilian, and my family is not from Brazil, but I felt so weirdly at home. And it's something that I still continue to process and think about. And there was a Santa Barbara, I believe. There was a festival for one of their saints, and everyone was like dressed in white, and it was like overwhelming and scary and wonderful. And I don't speak any Portuguese, and so I literally like I think a pretty good international traveler, but I didn't eat lunch the entire week I was there because I was so embarrassed to walk into places and be like, okay, Google Translate says moqueca. But we ended the trip on this island that was founded by escaped formerly enslaved people. And we took this like rickety piece of wood, like Huck and Jim, like out there, this sea jitney. And like going out, I'm like nervous and water's getting my face. And I'm like, this is not gonna end well. And then I get there and I walk to the top of the peak and I feel such intense, otherworldly freedom. And coming back, I ran my hands in the water the entire time, and I could see the bottom. And I was soaking wet, and I left there, and I went right to the airport, like, stinking of the ocean and of freedom and of this strange African-Americanness that I'd never known before. So that didn't make it to the book. But it's coming soon. There's one back here.
Hello.
Hi.
So I know Eric from The Moth. I saw a card on my seat and thought, oh, I'll come to this. And here I am.
Yay.
So I'm curious, what is your favorite Moth theme or themes and why?
Oh, gosh. Okay, I got to be honest with you. And you probably saw this at the show the other night. I don't remember the theme when I'm there on stage. I don't have a very good memory, which is why I write books about things that happened to me in the past. What is my favorite Moth theme? What do you think? What's that? Groan? Oh, yeah, Groan. Groan was good. Groan. There was one, what was it? Groan or Revenge, I think, was a good one. Sweat? I don't think I did Sweat. I don't know. I'm sorry. I'm trying to find a good answer inside this terrible answer, but I'm lost. No, I don't know. Back to School was pretty good. I don't know. You know what? Everyone's going to return their book. They're like, he didn't know anything about The Moth. Yeah, I don't know. One of the things I find about The Moth is that sometimes when the theme is too specific, or you're like, oh, we're going to get a lot of great stories about, you know, oh, there was one, stakes was, and I was like, all right, every story has stakes, you know? And I think that most of the stories were good, but I wasn't like, oh, wow, it's Zowie. But then it's like, the theme is like bubblegum, and people are like, my father invented bubblegum. And then he had to run from the mob, and you're like, whoa. I'll think about it. I'll do some research. I've been hosting The Moth for it'll be 10 years next June. Remarkably, I'm still in my 20s. Let's go over here. I'm a disaster person.
It's so rare to read or watch something that makes you laugh out loud. And your essays that I get in my email make me laugh out loud. Like, it's... Okay. It's incredible. And I wonder, in your writing process, how important is that to you? Like, are you really thinking through the scene and, like, making it funnier, or is it just coming natural? Because it feels super natural, and I'm like, this guy has it. I love it.
Oh, thank you. I love that. I love all these questions. Yeah, you know, I am... It's funny, because with the newsletter, there are times where I'm like, oh, nothing funny happened to me this week. And like, and so then I'm just like, well, let me just like wander around conversationally until I find something. Or something, at least I just don't write it. But I am always trying to find the funny. And that was kind of an interesting transition into book writing, because Sarah would always say, like, you don't have to hide behind the joke. And I'm like, oh, no, Sarah, I'm 1,000% joke. Like... but doctor, I am Pagliacci, you know, or whatever the clown's name is. What a silly reference to make. But I am always thinking about comedic structure, and I am always thinking about, like, sort of how to weave that into the story, you know, and sometimes it's like, you know, last week I wrote about how I don't give a flaming hot damn about the aliens. And sometimes it's really nice to just be like, I'm going to rant for 700 words, and then bingo bango, see you later, buy my book. But then sometimes, you know, I've been working on this one for almost 9 months. I've been learning how to swim at a gym in South Philly, and I want to write about it. And like, there's jokes where I'm like, I really want to tell you this story, and I can't, like, I'm still like searching for it. So it's a little 50-50, but it does always start with the joke. I feel like I want more laughter, you know. So any other questions? Oh, great, we got a question there. Oh, and then we got a question here and then there. Yeah, 500.
Can you talk a little bit about your experience writing for Dickinson?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, yes. It's interesting. So I was on a show, like a live podcast, where they were like, we're not talking about our TV work because we're striking. I have not received that directive from the WGA, so I do not believe that what I'm about to say is scabbing, and it's not my intention to. So I just want to say that. I know this is on camera. Yeah, but what I can say is that one of the things that was most exciting to me was taking Emily Dickinson's poetry and using it as the scaffolding for every part of the show, both the tone and the theme and the action, like everything was kind of based essentially on real life. And there was this one moment, you can read about it in the New Yorker, there was like a reporter came and was embedded in the room for a couple of days, and we're talking about the last episode of the series, which I co-wrote with Elena Smith, and we're talking about those fascicles that she would make, these little notebooks of poetry. And we're talking about the dress that she designed for herself that was utilitarian, you know, and like the pocket was the size of a fascicle. And we were just discussing what does the writer body need for armor? How do you design a dress? Like, you measure it in fascicles, you know? Is there verse stitched into it? And that was so deeply exciting because we're like talking about it, and then we are. The thing with Dickinson is that you run into a plot problem and you're always like, and then Emily pulls out her cell phone because you're like, oh, we can't get around this, you know, like, but she didn't. She couldn't, you know. And so we were like, in that moment, we were like, Velcro would really work the best here. And then we're like, well, was Velcro invented back then? And no, it was invented in the space race or whenever. I don't know. You probably know, but you're at a library. You know better than I. So, yeah, it was exhilarating. In the room with me were Lynn Nottage and Z-Way, among others. So the first time I opened up the Zoom, and this is, you know, June of 2020. So I'm just like, well, life is over. And I open up the Zoom, and there's Z-Way and Lynn Nottage. And I was like, well, life has begun anew. So that was great.
So I really love reading the acknowledgement section.
Oh, yeah.
Of every book I read. And you have such juicy ones all the time, and here for it was like making me cry laughing through it. So what inspired you to write it so long and so wonderfully?
Oh, I'm deranged. I have problems. Here's the thing. They edit everything and they're like, calm down, stop it, no more jokes. But the acknowledgments, I'm just like, mom and dad aren't home, pizza party on the couch. And with my first book, I literally thanked everyone I've ever met because I didn't know what you were supposed to do. I was like, who am I acknowledging? I lived this story, end of it. But thanks to everyone who made it nice. And then Kings of Bemore, they were a little bit shorter, but it was like I started off a little funny and I was, you know. And then with this one, I was just like, mom and dad are gone for the weekend. And so I literally, the acknowledgments in this one are literally addressed to you. You're like, if you read the acknowledgments, you're part of a special club. There's a special website in here. Crazy, crazy time. But I just like, it feels, actually, I'm gonna read the very end. So it goes on too long. Everyone at Penguin Random House agrees, and I cannot hear that. So the very end says, thank you for coming to my acknowledgments party. They sometimes feel a bit like what I imagine a retirement might feel like, getting to see and say thank you to the people who make it possible for you to do the work you do. Frankly, we should all be able to get the affirmation of a retirement party whenever we want. Or maybe not retirement, because I presume you'll still want to get paid. What about lifetime achievement? Who can say what all can be achieved in a lifetime? Maybe we should lower the bar. I feel like I'm just having thoughts in the acknowledgement section. The book has ended. Like, this is like a Marvel cutscene that they're like, we didn't, like Samuel L. Jackson's like, why am I here? I should put him next time. Okay. I feel like people should be able to declare lifetime achievement award status at any moment. Like the election pundits who are like, I've seen enough, I'm calling it. That, but for your contribution to humanity. The award should also be called, I've seen enough. If you're giving the award to Jennifer Lopez, the award should be called, I've Seen Enough. It's a movie starring Jennifer Lopez. But in general, the award should be for living, not achieving. I think that's the miracle. So yeah, they can't catch me. Oh, there was one down here. We're still going to tell you.
I love this question of, you know, who are you planting a garden for now? And I just wonder, when you got to the end of this book, do you have any new realizations about who you're planting a garden for. Do you mind sharing?
Oh, yeah. Ugh. Yes, I'm trying to think what I feel comfortable sharing. Sorry, I'm like, that's a really good question. And I'm like, oh, I'm in my feels. I think, so one, I'm sharing it for, this is, I think, maybe a little bit of a cop-out, but I'm sharing it for the version of myself that forgets this later on. In my first book, it ends, the epilogue is this conversation between a bunch of older versions of myself, and like the 40-year-old version, I come back and I'm wearing a nice suit, very rich, it says in the stage directions. And then like there's a 52-year-old version who's wearing the same suit, but it's really ratty. Not so poor, pretty poor, you know? And like, predictions. And I did this interview today with, I won't say where, but the woman who was interviewing me, she was like, you've been on strike for a while, so your finances are really taking a hit, right? And I was like, yikes! And I was like, you know, I like to work, you know? And she's like, she kept going. She's like, you're poor. You're on the street. You're rattling a cup. You look like Robin Hood when he's got the little glasses on and the thing. So I was like, yeah, okay, I'm destitute. Buy my book. I think, so I write it for the version of me that forgets it. I think a lot about our niece and nephews and the world that they're going to inherit. They already inhabit it. They're like, they're in space. They're with the, no, not with the aliens. I also think, I don't want to valorize the work that I'm doing. I think that the work that other people do, I think that it's and human effort is important, but like, I don't think that what I do is capital I important. But I do think that there is somebody who is going to encounter something that I wrote or experienced and shared and come away thinking differently about themselves in the same way that I encountered things that other people shared, whether it was James Baldwin or Jenny Lawson, and held on a little tighter to something beautiful inside. I also write to the mystery shape, the mystery shadow, the mystery person on the horizon that I don't know yet who is going to be in my life in the way that everyone that I've ever met was once a mystery, once a stranger. I worked with this wonderful woman, Melissa Kadig, at Pod Restaurant years ago, and we were such immediate friends. And every time I would come into the little teeny pod office, she'd be like, what if we never met? And I run into her all the time, and I'm like, what if we never met? And I think about that. What if I never meet the people I'm supposed to meet? And so I write to that. I write to the mystery, and I write to the missing, you know? So that's a really good question. I'm going to think about that. One more. We have time for one more question. Or I could tap dance. I'm just kidding. I'm not going to tap dance. Oh, Morgan, go ahead.
So, what books are you writing next?
What books am I writing next?
Yeah, and then the young adult books, because Kings of Baltimore, that was like a big hug.
Oh, yay,
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I do have a young adult. So I have a young adult. I'm working on, what can I say? I don't want to oversell this, because I'm going to look at this video in 5 years and be like, you were going to do what, Eric? I'm thinking a lot about the idea of inheritance, and so I'm working on this sort of like young adult series that's kind of Westing Game style mystery series about a group of young black cousins who have to figure out what to do with their very problematic inheritance. So that's way, way down the line. The thing that I'm writing right now is a adult rom-com set in the Poconos. I think that's all. I think, can I say any more about that? No, I don't want to oversell it. Yeah, it's about, no. It's about 220 pages. Yeah, no, I guess the phrase is May, December. It's not a romance, it's rom-com. It's, you know, about two men. One is in his early 30s, one is in his early 50s. So either, and they're diametrically sort of, oh God, I hate describing books. It's about people who thought that their chances had passed them by and who discover that that's not the truth. So I'm having a lot of fun. This town is full of kookalooks, and I come to the free library like once a week, and I do research on the Poconos that I immediately then throw away because it's a fictional town. But I'm like, well, that is interesting. They brought coal here on a horse? Okay, well, there's a laundromat, I think, in the town. There's a wedding theme bar in the town. It's real whimsy. There's a restaurant that only serves appetizers. Just, you know, just gay nonsense. So, thank you all for coming out.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/author events.